welcome to Sleeping Through Class. I'm Brendan Horaho, your host, and today I'm back with Kevin Beato.
Hello.
And I'm also here with Nick Rishkevitz.
Hello there.
We're here today to talk to you about American history, the first people that arrived in the Americas, and how the Europeans and Native Americans interacted with each other. And so, with that, we'll start off by talking about the Native Americans. So, in the very first part of a social studies class that I would teach, I would talk about the Native Americans and how originally they came over, probably from Asia, across the land bridge, which is sort of where Alaska is these days. And these hunter-gatherers came across, and they were sort of searching for food. And they came down following these herds of animals, and society started to develop down there. So to tell us about the early part of these Native American societies, we're going to hear from Nick.
Yeah, all right. So let's get started here. So as Brendan mentioned, the first people in the Americas, the first Native Americans, arrived thousands and thousands of years ago after crossing the land bridge called Beringia from Asia to the Americas, to North America, into Alaska and Canada, and then from there sort of progressed and migrated, likely following food sources. Brendan also mentioned that they were originally hunter-gatherers, which explains why they were migrating. Hunter-gatherers did not do farming. Okay, farming was invented, a lot like anything else can be invented. Farming was not something that people always knew how to do. So for a long period of human history, people were hunter-gatherers. They had to follow animals, herds of animals, to hunt, to get food. They also needed to gather, you know, things like different fruits or vegetables and stuff like that could be found in the wild, grains. And that led to a lot of migration. You know, it was a society where people really needed to move. Eventually, we have the Neolithic Revolution. And it's believed that in the Americas, this Neolithic Revolution, or this discovery of farming and agriculture, developed independently in a few different areas. South America, Mesoamerica, and then Eastern North America. And there's evidence around 3000 BCE that native peoples began to develop farming techniques. So that sort of gave us the rise to civilization. With farming, people could settle in one area, because if you're going to start growing crops, you need to be there to harvest them. You need to be there to protect them from animals, to protect them from other groups. So it leads to the growth of civilizations in the Americas.
So there's a bunch of different civilizations that start to pop up in the Americas. When I'm teaching my class, I try to keep it really, really simple. I talk about the Mayans first, and then I talk about the Aztec, and then the Incans. But there's one group that often, if you're not, you know, from central New York, you don't really hear about, but it's the Iroquois. So I wanted to touch on each one of these to sort of look at how these Native American societies were all in some ways similar, but in some ways very, very different. So let's start off by talking about the Mayan civilization. Kevin, can you fill us in on just sort of like some basic ideas of what the Mayans were like?
Yeah, of these ancient civilizations in terms of the Americas, I mean, most of them are not super ancient. The Mayans are the most ancient of them. They started first there in the Yucatan Peninsula in Central America, and they were composed of city-states, sort of like ancient Greece was. So in ancient Greece, you had Athens, you had Sparta, Corinth, and all these other city-states that made up the Greek states. And in Mayan civilization, we also had that sort of system popping up here. Something also interesting is that they had a system of writing that they used. They were very science-based, too, with astronomical observations. Actually, the land that they had was not very good for farming, so they had to come up with different ways to grow food in a pretty inhospitable climate, too. So definitely had a lot of science going on with them as well. And they did also go to war at times and were fairly successful as well, but they did die off before the Aztecs and the Incas came about.
Yeah. And so just to reiterate the idea of city-states. So like when I try to describe this to my classes, I always talk about ancient Greece. You had like Sparta and you had Athens. They're both culturally Greek, but they're very different, right? So they might speak the same language, they might not, but they have a very similar culture. So with the Mayan city-states, there are somewhere around 40 different city-states of various sizes, and they shared a lot of things in common, but not always the same language. Sometimes they fought with each other, but we always lump them together as a Mayan civilization because of those major commonalities.
Yes.
Yeah, similar to saying like an ancient Greek civilization, there were certain commonalities, while there were also a great amount of differences as well.
So after I introduced the Mayans, and we obviously look at the calendar and talk about how it didn't end in 2012, I start to take my classes and we look at the Aztecs, which I think are arguably the most fun Native American group to study. Nick, can you tell us a little bit about the Aztecs?
Yeah, so the Aztecs, also located in Mesoamerica, they settled on Lake Texcoco, and kind of an interesting story with them, or sort of legend behind them, is that they saw an eagle eating a snake while standing on a cactus, and if that sounds familiar, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but that symbol is actually found on the Mexican flag, so that's where that comes from. What I find interesting, what I like to tell my students with the Aztecs is, a lot of times, when we're thinking about these native civilizations, we have this sort of stereotype that they are, you know, living in sort of small tribal groups. Their civilizations are not very like complex or you know, stuff like that. But it's important to know that like with around the time of the arrival of the Spanish, of Europeans in the Americas, the Aztecs actually had a very large, powerful city. Tenochtitlan, which is now Mexico City, had over 200,000 inhabitants. That is incredible for that time period. It was bigger than both Paris, France, and London, England. So it kind of goes to show you that, yes, while there were some native groups that were more nomadic, or that lived in smaller groups, there were also large cities as well.
When I look at the Aztecs, I really like to tell my kids that, yes, they were bigger than, you know, Paris or London or anything like that. And just to sort of hammer home the point that these were huge, huge cities. They were made up of people who were ethnically Aztec, and then also smaller groups that had sort of been assimilated into their culture. And eventually that assimilation would play an important role in the Aztec culture, as the Spanish would use that those tribal differences to their advantage. So sometimes when we're studying the Aztec, we hear about these like super wild rituals and things. One of the things my students always love to hear about is human sacrifice.
Oh, yeah.
So what would you tell some students who are interested and want to understand why the Aztecs committed human sacrifice?
Yeah, the human sacrifice, they do it for all sorts of different reasons, from religious ceremonies to even just doing it to people that they had conquered and gone to war with. They have different ways of doing it, often pretty brutal, such as ripping your heart out while you're still alive, which is particularly gruesome and a favorite of students to learn about. Also, because in these civilizations, you often had these pyramids, sort of like in Egypt, you have them, but they're a lot narrower and thus steeper. And they'd also take you up to the top, you know, disembowel you and push you off the edge as a way to kill you as well.
Yeah. In a lot of these cultures, those pyramids were really important because the sun god was seen as the most important of the gods. So oftentimes, if you look at ancient Aztec drawings, you can see a human sacrifice where the priest has ripped someone's heart out of their abdomen and is holding the heart up to the sun and is basically giving the sun god an offering. And so you saw this across a bunch of different cultures. And the third culture we're going to talk about today is the Inca culture. And they also really were interested in the sun god. And I guess we'll talk about them now, right? All right. So let's hear a little bit about the Inca culture and how they were different than the Aztec and the Maya.
So the Inca, they were actually located not in Mesoamerica, but they were located in South America in the mountains of Peru. And they're quite interesting as well. One of their biggest kind of, I guess you could say, technological advancements, or one of the things I like to point out to my students that's kind of interesting is they lived in the mountains, and obviously in the mountains, it's not very easy to do farming. We talk about how it would be difficult to kind of make sure that your crops receive the water that they need to grow and stuff like that. So we talk about terrace farming, and it's sort of an example of these people modifying their environment to make it more hospitable for them. So what they would do is basically create sort of steps, if you can imagine, going down a mountain. And then on those steps, which were called terraces, they would put the crops, and because it was sort of, you know, changed the texture of the mountain to more of a flat geographical appearance, they would be able to grow crops, the water would be able to kind of pool up there and make sure that their crops were receiving the water that they needed. And I believe the Inca were also known for having a pretty strong road system through their empire to communicate, to be able to move soldiers if they needed to, mm-hmm. to different parts of their empire. And that's something that can be compared to, and oftentimes is compared to, civilizations like the ancient Romans, who also had a very strong road system to be able to manage a large empire.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's exactly what I was thinking, the comparison with the Romans. You have the Incas where they have their capital city in Cusco, but they're able to control this huge sort of empire because they would have these runners that would go from station to station, and they basically played a huge game of telephone in order to send the messages from Cusco out to the rest of the empire.
Right, you have like a central government in Cusco, and they're able to control a large area, a vast amount of territory through this road system, and by being able to send messages and, you know, have their laws and their rules and stuff like that enforced.
The other thing about the Inca that I really love to show my kids is a video of Machu Picchu, which is the city in the sky. And so this city, Machu Picchu, it was sort of lost for a long time after the Inca were eventually conquered by the Europeans. And it was only rediscovered pretty recently, about 120 years ago. And when they went up, these explorers in the 1900s, and observed Machu Picchu, the stonework and the terraces that the Inca had carved out still existed. And it just really shows how good they were with masonry and with sort of like craftsmanship and design.
Yeah, very good stuff there. I would definitely like to get down there and be able to see that at some point in my life.
The final group for Native Americans that's worth mentioning, and there were a lot, there were some in the southeast and the midwestern part of the United States, but the final group that we're going to talk about today is the Iroquois. If you grew up anywhere near New York, you were bound to hear about the Iroquois. Kevin, what can you tell us about the Iroquois?
The Iroquois. So the Iroquois is a term given to them by the English being the ones who largely settled large parts of New York. The actual natives themselves typically call themselves Haudenosaunee. Don't worry, you don't have to learn how to spell it or even pronounce it, but means people of the longhouse. So the members of the Iroquois nation are known for these vast longhouses where upwards of 60 people would live in them at a time. And the Iroquois Confederacy was made up of, for the most part, five main tribes: the Mohawk, Seneca, Oneida, Onondaga, and Cayuga. But there's also the Tuscarora tribe that's also involved. And something interesting about them is that they're more matriarchal. So instead of, you know, the male-dominated society, the women are the ones who step up. That's where the lineage comes from. And then also the way that they're governed is through the Iroquois Great Council, which actually still meets to this day, is still a thing that members of these tribes will meet together. And the chiefs who would represent these tribes as sort of like elected officials were elected by the clan mothers of the tribes. So the women had a very big role in the Iroquois society.
So, Nick, I have a question for you. Why did the Europeans want to even show up in America in the first place? Why were they looking for this new world?
Well, we actually need to go back pretty far here to take a look at this, and it goes back to a time period that you may have learned about in world history if you've had that class already. If you haven't, do a quick refresher on it. So it goes back to a time period called the Crusades, which was a series of wars fought between Christians from Europe and Muslims from the Middle East over the Holy Land, places like Jerusalem. So shortly before that, Europe had fallen into the Dark Ages. Life was very dangerous. People lived in small communities where they were protected by a king. These kings did not have a huge amount of resources or power, but they were able to try to protect and keep their people safe. With the Crusades, the Pope, who was sort of the leader of Christianity in Europe at the time, called for Europeans to join together and go and retake cities like Jerusalem from Muslims who had conquered them. So they get together these great armies, and they would go to travel all the way to the Middle East. They would travel across Europe to the Middle East and fight for the Holy Land. And in some cases, they would take back cities like Jerusalem. Now, they were never able to fully hold on to them, but they did at times conquer them. But the interesting thing that kind of comes from this is sort of other impacts that we see. When these crusaders who went to the Middle East came back, they returned to their home kingdoms. They brought with them goods that Europeans had not seen. Okay, they brought goods from places like China, places like India, things that were like spices or silks, stuff like that. They bring it back to Europe. People obviously see these things, decide they want them, and what it leads to is a demand for increased trade to get that. So for a while, European traders were traveling to the Middle East to get these cool things that, you know, they wanted. Spices, silk, things that I mentioned before. That becomes more complicated, though, because a major city along the trade route, Constantinople, it had been a Christian city. So these Christian European traders were allowed to pass through it. It was also a center of trade. It was located between Asia, Africa, and Europe. Well, that city gets conquered by a group called the Ottoman Turks, and they are Muslim. Okay, and that happens in 1453. They no longer wanted to allow Christian European traders free passage through this city. And it leads to Christian European traders seeking other trade routes to get to Asia. Their alternative is to pay very high fees to guarantee their safety as they pass through Constantinople, and if that makes your travel more expensive, it's going to make all of the goods that they bring back more expensive. So they're going to start looking for new ways to get to Asia, ways that they don't have to go through Constantinople, they don't have to go by land, and they're going to start to look to go by sea.
So oftentimes, we look at these European explorers, and they decide to go by sea, but for a long time, people have not tried to cross the Atlantic. It was seen as sort of like this horizon, the edge of the world, and even though people had known for quite some time that the world was, in fact, a sphere, it was a globe, they had not tried to cross the Atlantic, and in 1492, Christopher Columbus is eventually able to cross the Atlantic because there were a lot of new technologies that the Europeans had access to. So, Kevin, can you talk about why the Europeans were able to finally make it across the Atlantic?
Yeah, so they had increases in, you know, astronomical discovery, so being able to map out the sky, which would tell them a lot about direction, as well as the development of the compass. Also better maps that they were able to create, and new ships like the Caravel, which was a small but fast and able ship. The Portuguese used the Caravels to actually find the initial sea route that they used to go to India and China, which was to go all the way around the edge of Africa, down towards Antarctica, and then you loop back up around the eastern part of Africa, and then you can hit Asia that way. But someone like Christopher Columbus saw this as a waste. Now, he thought the world was a lot smaller than it actually is. So he thought if you just, instead of going south, if you went west, before too long, you'd be in Japan or China or India. Now, he didn't know that his calculations were off by I don't know, 30, 40% or so. And there's this massive landmass in between. So in 1492, well, actually before that, he goes to the Portuguese who started the Age of Discovery and Exploration. And they say, no, we're not interested in that. We got this system going on where we go around Africa and it's working all right. So he goes next door to Spain and they say, yeah, sure, let's try it. We'll fund your trip. So he's given three ships and in 1492 heads west and lands in the Caribbean. He ends up making four different trips to this new world. And he was looking to find gold to bring back as well as, you know, any spices or goods or anything that he could bring back as well. He found not a lot of gold, a lot of indigenous people who he in turn would help to turn towards Catholicism and also enslaving. But he did eventually on Christmas Eve in 1492 discover in Haiti a mass amount of gold. And so that's when Spain, that's when Portugal, England, France, and all these other countries are going to start looking at this new world as something that they're willing to spend money on trying to go and exploit.
Well, wait a second. I went to grade school. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. And in America, a lot of states celebrate Columbus Day. So why do we celebrate Columbus Day? Did he make it to America? Did he make it to the United States?
He did not make it to the United States. The United States was not seeing Europeans in 1492. That would happen a little bit later on.
Yeah, in fact, he actually thought that he had landed in Asia. Even up until his death, he was insistent that he had landed in Asia and he had found a water route to Asia. But there were other sailors of the time, even people who had gone on voyages with Columbus, who claimed that this was not Asia. It was, in fact, someplace else. One of the more famous ones is a guy named Amerigo Vespucci, another Italian sailor who sailed to the New World. And his name, Amerigo, eventually gets kind of put on maps in a more feminine version as America, which becomes the name of the North and South American continents. So Amerigo Vespucci actually disputed what Columbus said. He claimed that it was someplace that Europeans had not been yet.
Yeah, my students here in North Carolina, often when October 10th or 14th or whatever it is rolls around, they get pretty upset that we're not celebrating Columbus Day. But I always take my time to tell them that Columbus wasn't really the greatest guy. One of the things that people often forget is that Columbus Day was created in the 1930s with Franklin Roosevelt, and he largely did it in order to help boost votes from the Italian-American community. And one of the things that people have an issue with Columbus Day these days is that Columbus, by a lot of accounts, including the accounts of Bartolomé de las Casas, they state that Columbus was kind of a bad guy, that he was possibly committing murders, that he was interested in enslaving the natives when he first met them, that there were cases of sexual abuse, some really, really horrible things. So I think that's one thing that we can kind of gloss over. Often when we celebrate holidays, sometimes we sort of forget why we're celebrating. And I think it's important to mention.
Yep, absolutely.
I agree.
So Columbus is sort of the first guy to come across the Atlantic. And then suddenly there's a race among the major European powers to come over to the Americas. And so this is sort of the beginning of the Age of Exploration. All these different countries, they fund these massive operations to send someone to the other side of the world to essentially look for three different things. One is gold. These countries want to get rich. The second is God. They want to spread their religious beliefs. And the third part is glory, which drives a lot of these individual explorers to become successful. So let's just rattle off a couple of the most famous explorers, and you guys can sort of chip in on what you know. Nick, can you tell us about John Cabot?
Yeah, John Cabot was an English explorer, primarily known for exploring the area around Newfoundland, which is in Canada today. with England and with a lot of these explorers, it's also important to note that while they were somewhat interested in this new world that they had discovered, they were still very focused on a Northwest Passage, on finding a passage around North America to get to Asia.
Nice. So you mentioned Cabot was looking for the Northwest Passage, and our next explorer, Amerigo Vespucci, you just touched on, he was basically looking to prove that we in fact had found new continents. And so he had gone down and basically traces the coast of Brazil as he explores these new continents. Kevin, can you tell me a little bit about Ponce de Leon?
So it's an urban legend that Ponce de Leon was searching for this fountain of youth. There's no evidence to suggest that he even thought such a thing existed. He was looking for gold and to make a name for himself. He first landed in Puerto Rico and then further into Florida, helped start the Spanish conquest there and the growth of the Spanish colonies, going from Florida in the United States, the current United States, all the way across towards Arizona. So that all started with Ponce de Leon and other Spanish conquistadors and explorers as well.
One of my favorite Spanish conquistadors and explorers to talk about is Hernan Cortes. And we're going to talk about him a little bit, but basically in 1519, he eventually ends up in Mexico and he's exploring and comes into contact with the Aztec Empire. He's one of the more vicious conquistadors that we see. And so we're going to talk about him in just a second. Two other guys worth noting. Nick, can you tell us a little bit about Ferdinand Magellan and Jacques Cartier?
Ferdinand Magellan actually sailed for Spain. He was the first to organize a voyage that went around the world or circumnavigated the globe. Magellan himself did not complete the voyage. He ended up being killed by natives in the Pacific. But his ships that he did organize, while his sailors had a tremendous loss of life, did end up circumnavigating the globe. So he gets credited for being the first European to send a ship around the globe. And Jacques Cartier was a French explorer. He helped to establish some French settlements in Quebec. That would kind of spark further French settlement in the area, where they would primarily focus on not only finding gold and converting to Christianity, but also trading for furs, which became very valuable in Europe. And the French tried to have a vibrant fur trade where they were collecting furs or animal pelts from North American animals, particularly the beaver was very popular, to be sold in Europe.
These voyages led to the eventual settlement of conquered lands. And so the natives, they basically start to be conquered, right? And one of the major reasons they're conquered by these other groups, these European groups, is really sort of just the issue of technology. One, the Europeans show up and they have better weapons than the natives. Two, they show up and they have, you know, armor versus the natives, who are usually not wearing any sort of, you know, protective gear. And the third thing, the thing that actually killed more people than bullets or swords or anything like that, was disease. And so disease ends up having a huge, huge impact. And it's something the Europeans didn't actually know they were even bringing. So why don't you go ahead, Kevin, and tell us a little bit about the Columbian Exchange and how there were both positives and negatives from this new world.
So in a nutshell, the Columbian Exchange is the exchange of goods and products from the Old World to the New World and the New World to the Old World. So from the Old World to the New World, Old World being like Europe and Africa, you'd have things like livestock, guns, gunpowder, grains like wheat, barley, grapes, bananas, onions, and olives. And then going back from the Americas to Europe, you'd have peppers, avocados, turkeys in terms of animals going back there, pineapples, tomatoes, corn's a big one, sweet potatoes, and probably the biggest one of all would be tobacco, since Europeans get addicted to it and now they need that constant supply of tobacco.
So, Nick, can you tell us, there were lots of fantastic things that went back and forth, but can you tell us a little bit about some of the negatives?
Yeah, unfortunately, there were also some negatives with the Columbian Exchange, the biggest being what you touched on earlier, which is disease. One of the more kind of well-known diseases that was brought by Europeans was a disease called smallpox, which was, I guess it kind of looks like chickenpox, but it was very, very deadly. And so kind of what happened with this is that smallpox was a disease that existed in the old world. It existed in Europe and in Africa. And as a result of that, over generations, people in those parts of the world kind of evolved to develop antibodies to be able to fight off those diseases. So they were not as deadly to Europeans or to Africans. But when those diseases like smallpox are brought to the New World, to Native Americans who have never had contact with these Europeans before, and these diseases are transmitted to them, it ends up being very, very deadly. The natives, their bodies had not built up their immune system to be able to fight off those diseases. So when they were affected by them, it ends up being extremely deadly and wiping out a huge amount of their populations.
When we're studying these Native American civilizations, the Aztec, the Inca, the Maya, it sort of seems inevitable. They will fall. And one by one, they sort of do get destroyed by the Spanish. And so can you, Kevin, tell me a little bit about the fall of the Aztec?
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned earlier, in 1519, that's when Hernan Cortez gets in contact with the Aztecs. And then it's only about 2 years later that you see the collapse of them. When Cortez meets them, they're basically at their height. It's a very rapid decline for them once the Spanish show up. And there's certainly no shortage of enemies to the Aztecs. And when Cortez put his heart and soul into destroying the Aztecs, he had no shortage of people that he could find to side with him, because this isn't like a Spanish army going over there and fighting them. It's Cortez, it's some other guys, and then, you know, they're almost like their band of merry men that's going over there. So they're getting thousands upon thousands of allies that hate the Aztecs to help him fight against them. They end up laying siege to the capital of Tenochtitlan, which between the siege, fighting, since it is a war, and also a smallpox outbreak that breaks out in the city, hundreds of thousands of Aztecs die, which leads to the fall of the Aztec capital. And then sort of in its ruins, Mexico City, which is now a massive city in Mexico and their capital, was built. And that's where that comes from.
Yeah. And one of the things I think people often forget about with Tenochtitlan was that city was designed to be protected. It was actually a floating city on Lake Texcoco. And so the city mm-hmm. had these causeways that would lead to land. And whenever there was a threat, just sort of like a drawbridge, they could take the causeways and pull them in to protect them from the city. And so Cortez really had to be creative, and he had to be pretty smart to get these groups to work together in order to overpower the Aztec anyways. Let's talk a little bit about the Incas and what happened with them. Nick, can you give me a summary of how the Inca fall?
Yeah, so the Inca actually had a leader, Huayna Capac, who was kind of ruling the nation, and eventually he ends up dying. Following his death, their empire fell into a civil war, and that left their empire weakened. Obviously, already weakened from this civil war, they come into contact with a Spanish conquistador named Pizarro, and Pizarro and his men are able to overtake the Incan Empire with their horses, with their gunpowder, and also with the help of disease.
One of the interesting stories with the Inca is the story of Atahualpa, who was actually taken hostage by the Spanish, by Pizarro and his men, and they demanded a room full of gold from the Inca people, and the Inca, just like the other civilizations we mentioned, were enthralled with the sun god, and they thought that gold was basically drops of the sun that had fallen to earth, and so with this ransom, they end up paying the ransom to the Spanish, and they give a room full of gold to Pizarro and his men. But Pizarro knows that this guy, Atahualpa, is so important to the resistance against the Spanish conquistadors and against the Spanish Empire. He kills him anyways. So the Inca are just in a horrible, horrible situation. They pay the ransom. The hostage is killed anyways, and the empire does fall apart. It's just absolutely savage how brutal these civilized Europeans could be. The final group that I want to talk about is the Mayans. And sometimes the Mayans get left out because the Incas have a really great story. The Aztecs have a pretty interesting story as well. But the Mayan cities, they slowly were conquered by the Spanish, one by one. Remember, they were individual city-states, so they didn't have a unified resistance to the Spanish. And the Spanish basically went throughout the Yucatan Peninsula and one by one conquered all of these cities. But it took a really, really long time because they were spread out and because they were disconnected. And so in that sense, the Mayan were actually, because they were not centralized like the other civilizations, they were able to prolong their eventual demise. So we look at all these civilizations and these massive native civilizations. Some of them are destroyed pretty quickly by the Spanish. Some take quite some time, and some of these smaller native civilizations still exist. But one of the key things that the Europeans realized as they were coming into the Americas is that if these natives are here, it's going to make it a lot harder for colonization. The Europeans were hoping to basically set up these new little colonies, these new little small countries where they could mine resources, where they could set up little towns, where they could grow crops, where they could trade. So they set up these outposts in the New World as essentially ventures to try to make money. And so in our next episode, we are going to be discussing how the Europeans would take advantage of this newly freed land that a lot of natives had given up. In some cases, the natives lost their land because it was stolen from them. In some cases, they were tricked and were basically traded it away for nothing. And in some other cases, they were forcibly removed. So, for Kevin, for Nick, and for myself, thank you again for joining us for this episode of Sleeping Through Class. Thanks. Bye.